A couple of months back, in the month of May this year, I was invited by Auroville International, that was held in Berlin, to give a talk on management by consciousness. Well, as you know, I hardly know anything about management, and I started looking around and see what could be said about that. We have a couple of good books even on that topic, as most of you must have read. But then I thought all these articles that were there are more or less principles that were, you know, a kind of a guesswork, what should be the management by consciousness. So I was not much too happy to really read those articles, and then I said, produce something out of this reading. Then I saw that why not I take up someone who really did management with spiritual consciousness. And obviously, the best example before me was the mother herself. So then I thought, this is no more theorizing, but to really analyze and see how the mother herself did the management and what could be put down as principles of management used by the mother. Then I thought that would be more authentic, because I had the opportunity of seeing the mother grow up under her for quite many years. So then I went back in memory and started looking around what she did exactly. So this article is based on my personal, analysis of the mother's own work. I'm not a management expert, but I grew up under an expert of management. She was the mother herself. She had not studied in any management school or attended seminars on management principles, but for almost 47 years she managed a growing institution, the Sri Aurobindo Ashram, and in later years Auroville, giving to each inmate not only an opportunity to grow in his or her innate capacities, but also to express his or her innate and outer nature, to develop his or her integral consciousness, the inner being, the soul. The quadruple principles of our management of the most diverse conglomeration of human beings, both at the ashram and Auroville, could be summarized perhaps as wisdom, power, harmony, and perfection. These principles were all wrapped in divine love and not in a shroud of fear, the fear of the board of management or the boss. I guess these principles could be considered, seen from a particular angle, as the essential principles of management by consciousness. Wisdom. The central guiding principle of action of such a management by consciousness was, all can be done if the God touch is there. When we were in the ashram in our childhood, we always felt confident of ourselves in work, in play, in life, because we had the immense faith in this spiritual dictum given by Sri Aurobindo. In a different manner, the same principle formed one of the central guidelines of the Gita itself. Yatra Yogeshwara Krishna, Yatra Partho Dhanurdhara. Wherever there is Sri Krishna, the master of yoga, and Arjuna, the wielder of the bow, There shall be found wealth, victory, general welfare and unwavering justice and ethical sense. When the human effort, here represented by that of Arjuna, is supported or sustained by the wisdom of the total vision and spiritual consciousness of the highest order, here represented by Sri Krishna, then there is not only the well-being of the individual but also the welfare of the community and the nation. But unfortunately, modern man has alienated himself from this ancient truth of Naranarayana, of the combined action of man and God to manifest and to fulfill God in life. Modern culture, as we understand, grew out of the 18th century Protestant Reformation and the Enlightenment. It gained universal approbation in the late 19th century through the movement of French Revolution and came to its own in the Industrial Revolution and the Industrial Socialism of the 20th century. It promised, as writes David Gray Griffin in his book Spirituality and Society, it promised to emancipate humanity from natural and religious limits. But instead of liberating humanity, modern culture seems to have brought humanity to the edge of self-destruction. David Ray writes, "We now face the slow threat of the ecological poisoning and a rapid threat of nuclear holocaust. In the meantime, great energies of human exploitation, oppression and alienation are unleashed across the three worlds. The modern dream has turned a full circle. Seeking to free itself, modern scientific progress has become precariously uprooted from the earth, from the human community and its tradition, and above all from the religious mystery. But luckily for us, the children who grew up at the ashram, we were outside the scope of modernity's self-destruction. We were at all times wrapped in a divine mystery. The mother showed us constantly that it is the divine who is behind all expressions of life, be it political, cultural, religious, economic or social expressions. In fact, as we grew up, life itself was slowly unraveling the hidden secrets of the divine presence. And to that presence, we learned to surrender progressively. We were ready at all times to be given into her will, to give into her will and wisdom in matters small and big. To give you an example of how we were taught to surrender when we were children, whenever I had to go to Chennai or any other place, I used to write to the mother seeking her permission and also telling her the details of the purpose of my going. She would graciously give us the permission, writing on the letter blessings, etc. Writing to her for such small things was perhaps an insignificant thing. But even in more matters, which changed the destiny of my life, I learned to surrender to her guidance. Here is an example again. After completing my education in the ashram, I was planning to go to the USA for my higher education. So I wrote to the mother on 17th January 1969 seeking her decision regarding my desire to go to the US. I had even communicated to the authorities at Monmouth College, Illinois, USA, through my father who was there at that time, that I would be joining from the winter semester. Still, after posting the official admission form to the university, I wrote to the mother, "I await your decision, your choice, your advice, your will and your blessings," indicating that the final decision would be hers. She replied on the same day, "I can tell you immediately that all depends on what you expect from life. If it is to live an ordinary or even successful life, according to the usual old type, go to America and try your best. If on the contrary you aspire at getting ready for the future and the new creation it prepares, remain here and prepare yourself for what is to come. You will answer on your birthday. Blessings. For the modern youngsters, it may sound funny, and they could ask me, couldn't you decide for yourself? We are free to decide our own destiny, is it not? But that was not the attitude we had in our younger days. We were learning the spiritual lesson of the process of surrendering to the higher consciousness represented by the mother. After all, yoga begins with surrender and ends with surrender to the divine. So for us it was not a teaching, it was more a living process of a spiritual growth. In this example we see that one of the mother's foundation of working with human beings was self-offering and conscious surrender to the divine consciousness. Surrender to the divine was the only security of our life, and in her guidance we had found the meaning of all our action. And most often her guidance, her replies to our queries would come as a happy surprise, as seen in the letter quoted above, perhaps instructing our minds that it cannot plan and execute as it wants, that there is a higher consciousness which, when surrendered to, guides us, cutting across all logic and reasoning of the human mind. On one side we felt her immense grace, and on the other we felt her sweetness. She was indeed the central authority of the ashram's management, but she did not act as a CEO, blind with the power of professional egoism. Her authority was centered in her having a far superior spiritual consciousness than the human, which could regard all devotees and non-devotees with equality and equanimity. She kept in view the totality of work and the needs of managing the ashram and Auroville, which she did on different levels, such as the physical, the psychological and the spiritual, ranging from the physical to the supra-physical. She was at all times generous, sweet, loving, understanding and forgiving, but at times strict, where there was hypocrisy and insincerity and falsehood. As an organizational leader, she set high examples of aesthetics, work discipline, interpersonal relations, positive attitude and a high aspiration for a change and transformation of the lower nature into the higher. Apart from her dealings with the human beings, the other fundamental lesson that we learned from her wisdom was the equation between spirit and matter. We came to understand that matter is the body and form of the spirit. Because of this profound equation, which became a living truth of our life, we knew that our own body is verily the temple of God. Going further, if that were the truth on the individual level, then it should be so on the collective level too. Human society is also an embodiment of the collective or the group soul. Further, nature and the whole earth itself is an embodiment of the spirit, a physical extension of the divine. All is a single whole, the divine consciousness. Power. This changed worldview, a recovery of Vedic vision, definitely determined our way of thinking, feeling and acting. In the earlier centuries, religion had made the power of God more powerful than that of divine love. This belief in an omnipotent and intolerant God had reflected in the ruthless attitudes of the human managers, who dealt inhumanly with their workers and employees. The tendency to believe that God is only transcendental and not immanent ultimately led to the stage of thinking that there is no God. And atheism seemed to be the best solution, for the atheist would be more humane and rational and less despotic. But unfortunately it was not to be so. Bereft of belief in the divine, man succumbed more to his demoniac ego, became immoral and violent, and his relations with his colleagues and the subordinates in the work area suffered more disastrous consequences. But having been given more of an Unitarian vision of existence, We learnt in our relationship with others to be non-coercive and more collaborative. In fact, even those who were in charge of some of the departments of ashram were discouraged from dominating or imposing their views upon their co-workers. All tried to carry out with the utmost sincerity the work that was given to him or her by the mother. Each tried to follow her dictum without ever doubting her decisions, wisdom, or questioning her attitude. Each tried his best way to follow what the mother would want in a particular situation. Nothing else mattered. No other principles of management were applicable. Personal feelings, differences of opinion, were all drowned in the wave of harmony that originated from her consciousness. Those who were not receptive to the command of the higher consciousness, or those who resisted or opposed her wish and will, did often revolt, but suffered for sure disharmony and despair and depression in their own inner being. The mother was slowly establishing an ideal institution with exemplary management principles, while the world in general languished in dualistic and materialistic worldviews. Convinced by dualism, which proposed that human beings, by virtue of their superiority in creation, were totally different from all other creatures of the world, men in general got a sense of superiority, which in its turn brought in the unholy right to exploit nature and utilize her for his fancies and comforts and pleasures. This anthropocentric and its consequent materialistic view resulted in an increased tendency to treat other human beings, writes David Ray Griffith, especially women and primitives, as mere objects. But the practice of regarding some as parts of the world as mere objects, totally devoid of intrinsic value and deity, made easier by force of habit to treat other human beings as mere objects, especially women and dark-skinned peoples, which many European males regarded as more natural, hence less human. As regards the notion of regarding others and especially women as mere objects, it did not enter our ken of understanding. The divine is equally in all, and thereby all were to be treated equally. It is said in the Upanishad, one does not love the wife for the sake of the wife, but for one's self's sake one loves the wife. So we were trained to view all as forms and figures of the one divine consciousness. In fact, women are supposed to have greater openness to spirituality, we were told by the mother. This attitude was also seen in us having a co-education, and even in our physical education activities, no discrimination was made between girls and boys. I suppose the mother established this gender equality long before the Western world woke up to its women's liberation movements. Harmony. So, to achieve harmony and beauty between not only human beings, but also between man and materials, used or produced, was the daily dose of consciousness that was given to us by the mother. Not only was harmony being established between the in-charges of the several departments of the ashram and the co-workers between men and women, but mother pioneered what has come to be known today as the ecological view of existence. She had experienced, even when she was a child, a close communication between herself and nature. Birds and animals endeared themselves to her, and she could even communicate with them. That is how she established the inner contact with the flowers and named thousands of flowers after their inner vibration and aspiration. Such a communion with the flowers and fauna gave us a consciousness of interdependence of each species and each individual in the world. The deep ancient vision of Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam, the whole human family, humanity is one family, had become the reality of a daily existence for us. Such a living of oneness with our surroundings saved us from the ecological crisis, which is these days one of the main themes of management studies. That is why we were surprised when we read later what the critics wrote. Again, I quote David Ray, "Postmodern thought is ecological through and through, and it provides the philosophical and theological grounding for the lasting insights popularized by the ecology movement. If it, in fact, becomes the basis of new paradigm of our culture, future generations of citizens will grow up with an ecological consciousness in which the value of all things is respected and the interconnectedness of all things were recognized. To feel the divine consciousness permeate each animate and inanimate object, to experience the divine sweetness in the sap of life is the very essence of spirituality. The mother awakened in us this deep sense of oneness, this touch of divine harmony, sweetness and beauty in our daily life, because for her, management was a spontaneous expression of her consciousness and not something of a science or an art to be learned or adopted from books of management theories. She took the ashram sadhaks not as workers or ordinary inmates, but as living souls to whom she could impart their deeper oneness of nature and God and man. By all means and methods, she communicated this consciousness of unity and continuously guided the inner growth of their consciousness towards such heights. For the mother, it was the growth of consciousness of an individual that superseded all other considerations such as profit and loss. Once, when a sadhak asked the mother, "Mother, why is it that here in work some people venture to satisfy their fancies and thus much money is wasted?" She replied, "It is not money alone that is wasted. Energy, consciousness is infinitely, 1,000 times more wasted than money. Should there be no wastage? My word, I believe the ashram wouldn't be here. There is not a second when there isn't any wastage. Sometimes it is worse than that. There is this habit, hardly conscious, I hope, of absorbing as much energy, as much consciousness as one can, and using it for one's personal satisfactions. That indeed is something which is happening every minute. If all the energy, all the consciousness which is constantly poured out upon you all, were used for the true purpose, that is, for the divine work and the preparation for the divine work, we should be already very far on the road, much farther than we are. But everybody, more or less consciously, and in any case instinctively, absorbs as much consciousness energy as he can, and as soon as he feels this energy in himself, he uses it for his personal ends, his own satisfaction. Who thinks that all this force that is here, that is infinitely greater, infinitely more precious than all money forces, this force which is here and is given consciously, constantly, with an endless perseverance and patience, only for one sole purpose, that of realizing the divine work? Who thinks of not wasting it? Who realizes that it is a sacred duty to make progress, to prepare oneself to understand better and live better? For people live by the divine energy, they live by the divine consciousness, and use them for their personal selfish ends." This is from Collected Works, Volume 6. Of course, money and financial management had its own important place in the affairs of running the ashram or Auroville. For her, the idea that money must make money is a falsehood and a perversion. Money is meant to increase the wealth, prosperity and the productiveness of a group, a country, or better, of the whole earth. Money is a means, a force, a power, and not an end in itself. And like all forces and powers, it is by movement and circulation that it grows and increases its power, not by accumulation and stagnation. "Money is a power that is at present in control of the anti-divine forces," she said, and that by impersonal and desireless use of it, it could be brought back to the Divine's work upon earth. She explained further the deeper truth of possessing money and how to utilize it in a spiritual way. I quote the mother, "The conflict about money is what might be called a conflict of ownership. But the truth is that money belongs to no one. This idea of possessing money has warped everything. Money should not be a possession. Like power, it is a means of action which is given to you. But you must use it according to what we can call the will of the giver. That is, in an impersonal and enlightened way. If you are a good instrument for diffusing and utilizing money, then it comes to you. And it comes to you in proportion to your capacity to use it as it is meant to be used. That is the true mechanism. The true attitude is this: money is a force intended for the work on earth. The work required to prepare the earth to receive and manifest the divine forces. And it, that is the power of utilizing it, must come into the hands of those who have the clearest, most comprehensive and truest vision." I skip a few paragraphs. When the need to accumulate and the need to spend, which are both blind and ignorant, are combined, they can lead to a clear vision and a most efficient utilization. Then here comes slowly and slowly the possibility of putting it into practice. Money does not belong to anybody. Money is a collective possession which should be used only by those who have an integral, comprehensive and universal vision. I would add something to that, not only integral and comprehensive, but essentially true as well. A vision which can tell the difference between a use which is in accord with the universal progress and a use which would be termed fanciful. But these are details, for even the mistakes, even from a certain standpoint, the waste helped the general progress. These are lessons learned the hard way. So the mother dealt with money with a divine attitude. Once there was someone who wanted a loan from the mother, but the mother said, "The money is not mine. The money belongs to the ashram, and the ashram does not lend money." In spite of her being the head of the ashram and being the center of inspiration for all the donations to the ashram, she considered that the money coming to the ashram did not belong to her. A wonderful example of divine detachment indeed. Perfection. The mother kept high standards of the material things, ashram buildings, cars, furniture, etc., because matter itself is to be respected, cared for. Material objects have a sensitivity of their own and they respond to the touch of our love and care. Here we could give an example of the furniture at Golconda Guest House. Instructions written in the guest rooms tell us that one should not drag or change the position of the furniture except for the chair. No other change is acceptable. All this furniture is there for the last 59 years and almost kept in their original positions. This is the respectful care and attention we should have for all material things. What we see is that the ashramites maintain their cycles and vehicles in such a perfect order. Not that we do not do that in Berlin, but here it is done with the consciousness that it is the mother's vehicle, that they are only custodians of her property. For us, everything that belongs to the mother has to be taken care of intensely. This is, in a way, applied spiritually. We are not talking about the higher ranges of spirituality, but this is an all-inclusive spirituality which teaches us how to interact with the mother's consciousness through matter and material things. So, the material things were not supposed to be just used and thrown away, just as the employed workers in a company are to be just hired and fired. The ancient Indian tradition of the Ayudha Puja was a daily attitude with her. What is important here is that each object that we use and are in contact with has to be respected. In fact, even the pen, the pencil, the eraser, the computer, the table, the chair, all have their specific value. Each thing should be in its place, for each thing has its own proper place in a perfect, harmonious place. Beauty is in fact perfect harmony, a harmony where everything finds its proper place and respect. She instilled in us the true feelings for objects, especially those we use in our daily life. So we have to be careful not only in their usage, but in wasting them. Today, one of the reasons why the world economy is melting down is because we have wasted much and utterly disrespected matter. In a way, it reflects in our attitude, which is egoistic. It is a gross commercialism that has given us false values of matter. We use it almost promiscuously. Behind all these attitudes towards matter and money and management principles, there was one central motive, that of the perfection of man. All circumstances of life, all material comforts and discomforts, all events, sad or joyous, are there for the growth of human consciousness. If only one could be conscious of these ups and downs in life, as in sadhana, then the progress towards one's perfection would be faster and smoother. It is true that perfect perfection is obtained only on the supramental level, where matter is fully conscious and transformed. But one could always attempt for a progressive perfection here and now. Perfection is a state of harmony. It increases in dimension and depth as our consciousness enlarges. Behind this attempt to bring in perfection in our inner and outer nature, through our works and devotion and meditation, there is one principle that was emphasized by the mother. It was the freedom to choose. This is something I learnt myself when I was a student. She always gave us the choice. The letter that I earlier referred to is a very good example once again. She didn't say, don't go to the US. But she gave me two alternatives. One was, if it is to live an ordinary or even successful life according to the usual old type, go to America and try your best. And the other was, if on the contrary you aspire at getting ready for the future and the new creation it prepares, remain here and prepare yourself for what is to come. The choice was given to me. It was not imposed upon me. That is the principle of our education also. She said that we should always give the children the different possibilities and let the child choose. At the same time, it is the duty of the teachers and parents to tell the child what the result and consequences of his or her action and decision could be. She always said, you have the right to choose, but once chosen, you have no right to be indisciplined. This principle too could be a very important ingredient of management rules and regulations vis-à-vis co-workers and labor. This was the fundamental thing even in life. You have all the choices, but once you have taken to a particular choice, then you will have to follow that path. That is what is sadhana. Your freedom is there to grow spiritually. That's the true freedom. To express one's own vital desires and fancies is not freedom. That is only license. To grow spiritually, you have to have truer inner freedom. One was freedom of choice, and the other was consecration or self-offering. These are the two principles which could be applied to any management or to any spiritual life. Surrender to the divine. What does it mean? Some of you might question, especially the young ones, why should I surrender? After all, I am an independent individual. I have my capabilities, I have my possibilities. The mother tells us to surrender our weaknesses as well as our strengths, for surrendering is the only means to grow spiritually. But we think surrendering in itself is self-abnegation. It is not abnegation. It is on the contrary a means to grow out of our weaknesses, to increase our own potential, to increase our own capacity. If that is the essence of surrender, why shouldn't I do it? After all, I'm doing all these courses, classes, all my other works, etc., only to increase my capacity, only to increase my self-expression. If the mother says, I'm here to help you, you just raise your hand and I will hold it, what could be more wonderful? It is like the island seeking to rejoin the continent. Who is it that gains in such a situation? The mother is the continent of spirituality and we are the islands of ego. So she is not there, to take away our freedom, but she will give us the true freedom, the inner freedom. I told you that she asked us to surrender not only our weaknesses, but our strengths as well. Because we humans have a tendency to suppress our lower nature when going to a sacred place or when we go to see a spiritual person. But it could not be so in her presence. Even if we tried to suppress it, she saw it and she asked us to offer them to her willingly and consciously instead of her having to pull them out. Listen to what she has to say in this regard. People come for blessings in the morning. When they come to receive a flower, I have only to look at them. There is something around their heads. And at times it is as clear as though they said, this indeed is something I shall never tell. They tell me, never will I tell you this and this and that. You understand? They tell me this. By telling me that, they will not say it. By telling me I shall not tell you this, they tell me. In fact, in one of her conversations, she explained beautifully this phenomena of the personal darshan. When I see people and I'm busy with them, I want to see in them their psychic being, their ideal, what they want to do, what they want to be, in order to keep it, pull it out to the surface. All my work consists of this. What I see, I pull out always. Of this experience, of what the mother says, I want to see in them their psychic being, I can explain by giving my own example. The most marvelous thing I remember is that when I sat in front of her during the personal darshan, she used to grip my eyes with her look. When she looked into my eyes, it seemed that I ceased to exist for a while. The world did not exist, as it were. She pierced through my eyes and seemed to ask my soul what it wanted. Mentally and vitally, I may want a lot of things from the mother, but have I ever seen or heard what my soul wants? We are hardly ever conscious of our soul's demands. But when she would finish communicating with my soul, she would pull back her piercing look and burst with a smile, giving a gentle nod. Then I did my pranam at her feet, and again time was arrested. A sense of timelessness prevailed. Then she would touch me on my head, and when I rose up, she gave me some selected flowers. And when I would leave her room, she would always follow me till the door with her eyes. This is how she helped in our inner growth, helped us come out with our true spiritual needs. This was, I suppose, the result of surrender. This was her way of guiding our inner aspirations and putting in front of us our own highest ideal. In this process of self-offering and surrender, there was another message by Sri Aurobindo which helped me much in managing my own life. Always behave as if the mother was looking at you, because she is, indeed, always present. This has helped me to guide myself in many circumstances. Once you are convinced that the mother is omnipresent, you tend to act as if you were acting in her very physical presence. But if you believe that the mother is only in Pondicherry, in a physical body, it would be wholly false. She is not a physical form alone. She is the divine consciousness, ever present, omnipresent. The mother once commented on this aspect of hers. From this point of view, Sri Aurobindo wrote a little rule which for some time we had put up everywhere. But I believe it must have disappeared now, or else people are so used to it that they no longer even look at it. It said, always behave as if the mother was looking at you. And Sri Aurobindo added, because she is indeed always present, still these physical eyes, no, she is not there. And so the first thing is to hide things. Not only does one do everything that one wouldn't do before me, but as one doesn't at all believe the last part of Sri Aurobindo's sentence, that even though I am not there physically, perhaps still I know how things are. So the first instinct is to hide things. And the moment one enters that path, it is like stepping into quicksand. One goes down, down, down. It seizes you, swallows you up. It draws you down in such a way that it is very difficult to come out of it. Of all things, this is the worst. Awe, provided that mother does not know. And so it begins like that, and that's the end. Well, I hope not many among you tell lies, but still, usually the end of the curve is that. And so you understand, this is one of those stupidities without equal. For I'm going to tell you something, and I can tell you this with impunity. Even if you don't want that to happen, it will happen all the same. Collected Works, Volume 6. So you see, the mother is an omnipresent consciousness, and her photographs kept in different places in our houses, centers or offices are more of a reminder of her omnipresence. However, it is not like the religious belief that God is overlooking on you at all times in order to punish you or reward you. Yes, it is not the punitive attitude of the ancient God with which the mother's consciousness was looking at you. Nor is it of the company boss looking over your shoulder. It is more a consciousness which guides us through life, taking us nearer to our souls with each step in life. And this is best done by a sense of intimacy with the divine. For it is in the intimacy with the divine that we grow fastest in spirituality. In the usual management system, why is it that we are not able to open up inwardly? That's because of the fear of the superiors, fear of the targets to reach, fear of losing the job, etc. But here in spiritual management, we have the principle of love and intimacy. And those of you who know Bhagavad Gita, you would have noted that Sri Krishna and Arjuna were more like friends. They were intimate like two good friends, although one was an incarnation of God and the other a human disciple. When we look at God as some kind of a superior boss, then intimacy does not take place, for fear of God obstructs any intimacy with the divine. With the mother it was different. We looked up to her not as a disciple looking up to his master, but more as her children. Apart from friendship, the other intimate relationship with the divine is that of the mother and the child. If you want to be an instrument for the divine's work, it's better to be, more than being disciples, the children of the divine mother, and be guided by and cared for by her. After 1961 or so, we could not see the mother on a daily basis. But till then we saw her every day at the balcony darshan, or when we used to come to the ashram sports ground or the playground, etc. I've seen the mother expressing divine consciousness in every little act of hers. In all her acts and responses, she exuded this divine intimacy and sweetness in great abundance, and we profited by it to the extent we were open to her in our inner being. If the psychic is open within, then we can get all the guidance needed both in the inner and outer journey of life. In fact, we are told by sadhaks who had come to the ashram as children that the mother used to tell them constantly that the only value in life is to realize one's own psychic being, one's inner being. She would reiterate this in so many circumstances that today in those who have grown up under her, this advice seems to be the only ringing message in their ears. It is with her loving ministry of the ashram and Auroville that the mother established integral principles of management on a small scale as well as a big one. That is to say, the most important element of management, being man, the mother gave us a new vision of man, his weakness and capabilities and his awaited destiny. At the same time, the mother brought back the synthetic view of matter and spirit, emphasizing upon the truth that matter too can respond and reveal the spirit if we delve deeper into it with deep love and respect. She established in a living manner and not didactically the quadruple principles of wisdom, power, harmony and perfection, which in fact are the principles of spiritual self-management both on the individual and collective levels. With this living inspiration and guidance from the mother's ministry, if I can manage my own life and manage to agree to go a little deeper towards my own inner being, then I would consider that I have lived my life meaningfully. That, I suppose, is the goal of management by consciousness, to make each person manage his or her life in the light of his or her highest consciousness. It is said a drop of practice is better than an ocean of theories. So all these theories of management could be meaningless and all seminars on the principles of management redundant if we do not take a plunge into our soul and let it govern and manage all the parts of our being. For the soul within each one of us is the true manager, the true governor of our life. So let us recognize and install the divine manager within us, and then there would be no need of any outer principles of management. It would be a spontaneous harmonizing between the inner and outer, between each being and each object in the world, and that, I suppose, would be the acme of all ideals of management by consciousness. Thank you.